CBS News. I'm Cammie McCormick. New York City's mayor has just announced a new development in the anthrax case at NBC News. An aide to nightly news anchor Tom Brokaw contracted a skin form of anthrax, and authorities had been testing a suspicious letter from September 25th, postmarked St. Petersburg, Florida. It had tested negative. Now it turns out there was another letter.
It appears to be the 18th of September that was sent to Tom Brokaw. That letter was tested last night, and it turns out to be positive to anthrax.
Mayor Rudy Giuliani, the woman is expected to recover. We are expecting to hear this hour whether a letter that arrived at a Microsoft office in Reno contained anthrax. One previous test was positive, another negative. And the New York Times says preliminary testing has failed to turn up anything dangerous in a letter it received. The scares have a lot of people rushing to their doctors for prescriptions for antibiotics. Dr. Neil Cohen is the New York City Health Commissioner.
We urge physicians to resist some of the pressure that their patients are putting on them.
Federal health officials insist they have enough supplies of antibiotics should they be needed. The Pentagon confirms one of its jets inadvertently dropped a bomb on a civilian area in Afghanistan. CBS News reporter Tom Foti with the latest for us from Washington.
The incident occurred overnight Afghan time and is said to be the result of what the Pentagon calls target processing error involving a so-called smart bomb. The Pentagon statement expresses regret for the loss of civilian life and says U.S. forces do take great care to avoid such incidents.
The U.S. airstrikes have continued over the past few hours, and the USS Kitty Hawk is now in position. It may be used to station ground troops. CBS News military consultant, retired Air Force General Perry Smith.
You have a clean deck, a Kitty Hawk, a nice big carrier with lots of room, and you could put Army helicopters on there, you could put Marine helicopters on there, you could put Air Force helicopters on there, and it gives you a nice platform to do things that you normally don't do off a carrier.
The Taliban spiritual leader denounced the U.S. attacks again today and called on the Muslim world to support Afghanistan. President Bush used his weekly radio address to defend the U.S. military campaign.
Our enemy prefers to attack the helpless. He hides from our soldiers. But we're making a determined effort to take away his hiding places.
Humanitarian food drops do continue, some of them including Pop-Tarts and peanut butter, instructions apparently in English and Spanish. CBS News reporter Phil Itner in the North was watching as a mother offered some of the treats to her eight children.
She did open one of the packets to give out some of the sweeter things to her children. The children kind of took it skeptically, tried the peanut butter. That didn't go over too well, but they love the Pop-Tarts and they love the strawberry jam.
This is CBS News.
As you know, unprecedented tragedies have occurred in our nation. The American Red Cross is providing life-saving assistance, emotional support, and blood to those in need. You can help, too. Please call 1-800-GIVE-LIFE to schedule a blood donation, or call 1-800-HELP-NOW to offer your financial support for this and other disasters. Together, we can save a life. This message brought to you by State Farm, a proud sponsor of the American Red Cross.
Kids don't come with instruction books, so thank goodness for Mom and memories of cold, crisp mornings when she'd give me cream of wheat. So smooth and creamy. And now I know how good Mom felt when I see my kids dig in and then lick the spoon. And today, cream of wheat is rich in calcium, too. So when raising children, remember Mom and cream of wheat hot cereal. On a stove or in a microwave, it's still so good to hold on to.
Ukrainian officials now admit one of their missiles downed a civilian plane last week over the Black Sea. CBS News reporter Bill Gasparini has the story from Moscow.
Defense Minister Oleksandr Kuzmuk appeared unexpectedly at a news conference to admit responsibility in the crash. Kuzmuk said he wanted to apologize to relatives of the victims, mostly Israeli citizens of Russian descent who were traveling from Tel Aviv to Siberia. Russian investigators have established that an anti-aircraft missile exploded near the plane. Ukraine was test-firing missiles in the area at the time. Ukraine's president and Russian leaders have said they don't want the tragedy to strain relations between the two countries. Bill Gasparini, CBS News, Moscow.
The cleanup continues today in North Texas. A tornado last night tore down power lines and damaged dozens of homes and businesses north of Fort Worth. Firefighters are battling a wildfire in Santa Clarita, California. It's now grown to more than 4,000 acres. High winds have been fanning those flames. I'm Cammie McCormick, CBS News.
Mm-hmm. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, a wrap-up of the week with background and analysis from the correspondents who cover the news. And now from Washington, here's CBS News national correspondent Dan Rabib.
After the first full week of bombing Afghanistan, what's next? We'll consider that. And CBS News correspondent Mark Phillips will talk about slogans written on some of the bombs.
New York Fire Department, New York Police Department, this from the victim's family.
CBS News correspondent Dan Rather will chat about the big changes since September 11th.
I think we know what we have to do, and among the things we have to do is deal with our fears and then go on and prove that we are indeed the home of the brave.
More of that ahead with our series of reports on changes, including Howard Arenstein on charitable giving.
Thank you for calling about the September 11th fund.
Thank you for calling the American Red Cross donor assistance line.
If you wish to make a donation to the New York...
Hundreds of millions of dollars have been pledged, but...
The proof of the pudding is going to come after this.
And later, London correspondent Sam Litzinger on wartime broadcasts.
It also suggests how important radio can be in a country where TV sets are banned.
First subject, President Bush with an offer to Afghanistan's Taliban rulers if they surrender Osama bin Laden, President Bush calling him the evil one.
If you cough him up and his people today, we reconsider what we're doing to your country. You still have a second chance. Bring him in and bring his leaders and lieutenants and other thugs and criminals with him.
Let's turn to the White House now and CBS News chief White House correspondent John Roberts. President Bush seems like the man who's found his voice because he's found his issue. Thursday night's news conference was impressive, almost everyone says, John.
I think so. You know, he showed himself to be measured. He was calm. He was collected. He was serious. He really does seem to have found his voice, as you said, with this issue. You know, some people are born to greatness. Some people grow into it. Others have greatness thrust upon him. Don't want to suggest that that's the case, but certainly President Bush appears to have risen to the occasion here and is developing very quickly. People have said that he's a quick study. And he's certainly proving it with this issue.
John, what about that innovative idea that American children should each give $1 for Afghan children? Who came up with that, and is the White House quite serious?
Franklin Roosevelt came up with it in 1938. It's modeled after the March of Dimes. But let's not forget that while the cause is a good one, American children helping out Afghani children, it's also a very powerful image that the White House knows it's creating here, the idea of American children caring enough about Afghani children in the height of a war to each give a dollar. There's a certain public relations value to it that I'm sure that the White House hasn't missed.
CBS News chief White House correspondent John Roberts, the commander-in-chief summary of the first week of the air war.
We have ruined terrorist training camps, disrupted their communications, weakened the Taliban military, and destroyed most of their air defenses.
Now expected ground forces, U.S. Army commandos going in by helicopter, but when? And how do you stop or adjust the bombing not to get in the way? Let's turn to a CBS News consultant, the former head of the U.S. Air Force staff, General Ronald Fogelman.
First of all, just because you go to the next phase doesn't mean that you have to stop all of your air operations. In fact, that's not desirable. Each day, when you're involved in a conflict, the commander-in-chief in that particular region approves what is almost a master script, if you will, of where his ground forces are going to be, his naval forces, his air forces, and his special operations forces. And it is a job of a certain portion of his staff to make sure that they deconflict so that you don't end up bombing your own troops, etc.
Even when it's only air operations, you have to do that, of course. Some are coming from the U.S. and some from ships and some apparently from land bases.
That's a big production to put that, what we call the air tasking order together every day.
And if the president wants the armed forces to start smoking them out, that's the kind of phrase he uses, are we fully capable? Can U.S. forces, in fact, do that?
Well, I think what we have done is we have set the conditions to make that happen. What this now does is it gives you the capability to virtually track anything that moves in certain portions of the country.
Retired Air Force General Ronald Fogelman. Now to northern Afghanistan, CBS News correspondent Elizabeth Palmer with the anti-Taliban rebels in the United Front or Northern Alliance. who do have some secret communications with the U.S. military.
We know that because the foreign minister of the Northern Alliance was the first to say the attacks are imminent a couple of hours before they actually began. So obviously he'd been told, and they agreed to close their airspace, the airspace they control, for 5 days while the attack went on. So we know that some information is getting to them. But what we hear from field commanders on various fronts is that they're not getting a lot of information, and they're certainly not being invited into a partnership where the U.S. would act as the Air Force for the Northern Alliance ground troops, which is what they'd like.
Elizabeth Palmer, you're the CBS News correspondent in Moscow usually. So what about the Russian angle, the weapons that those anti-Taliban rebels have? They're mainly from Russia, aren't they?
Yes, I am now seeing new shells, new mortars, and some new tanks. A friend of mine came up from southern Afghanistan today in a spanking new Russian helicopter. And we do know that Russian convoys are crossing the border all the time. They have to cross a river, we can observe. Although we don't know what's in the trucks, it could be humanitarian aid, but it's very likely that they're chock full of arms. So the Russians not only helped by default, I suppose, in the 80s by leaving behind their weapons, they're also now opened the floodgates on a whole new torrent of arms destined for the Northern Alliance.
In this war on terrorism, Russia is on America's side. So's the Northern Alliance or United Front. But how long is that likely to last?
Well, you know, Russia, the United States, and the Northern Alliance are very uneasy bedfellows. I think you have to look at it in terms of what each wants out of this. The Americans would like to catch Osama bin Laden and destroy the training camps that are producing terrorists with a big mission to get back at America. Russia doesn't want to be at war with Afghanistan and doesn't want an unstable border with Afghanistan that's going to produce refugees or border skirmishes. And the Northern Alliance wants to rule here. Now, there's a lot of common ground for those people, or for those three parties, if you like. So you can bet from here, before they've even had to start negotiating, that whatever agreement they're going to come to will be very hard won, and the relationship is bound to be stormy.
But what they have in common, certainly the Americans and the anti-Taliban rebels, is to try to get rid of the Taliban regime and to find Osama bin Laden and his gang, who are mainly foreigners. Arabs are considered foreigners there.
Yes, but the Northern Alliance is less concerned with catching Osama bin Laden and seeing some sort of justice served out to these people than they are with actually getting a lock hold on power in this country. I think Osama bin Laden is really an obstacle to their controlling a place more than, they don't feel, I don't think, the same kind of mission and zeal to catch him and punish him that the Americans do.
CBS News correspondent Elizabeth Palmer in northern Afghanistan. Take good care. Thanks for speaking with us.
A pleasure.
Up next, what some of the U.S. pilots on bombing runs are telling CBS News.
Stay with us. The CBS News Weekend Roundup will be right back.
Hey, Irwin, are you crunching numbers for Sit and Sleep Snooze Now Pay Later sale?
No, Larry, the numbers are crunching me, especially this 1 year, no deposit, no interest, and no payment deal.
But, Irwin, during Sit and Sleep Snooze Now Pay Later sale, we're giving people with good credit 1 whole year to pay for a comfortable new mattress.
But, Larry, 1 year with no payments means someone who sleeps 8 hours a night gets 2,920 free hours of sleep.
Right.
Or how about someone who snores 500 times a night? That's 182,500 free snores a year.
But, Irwin, during Sit and Sleep Snooze Now Pay Later sale, people can buy a premium Simmons, Sealy, Serta, Spring Air, Stearns & Foster, Mirlitch, or Chatham & Wells mattress today and not pay a penny for a whole year. Plus, get free local delivery. What are you calculating now, Irwin?
How many more seconds I have to work for you until I retire? Because you're killing me, Larry!
Call 800-675-3536. Sit and Sleep will beat anyone's advertised price, or your mattress is free!
Right now, exclusively at all Ken Crane's home entertainment centers, the Panasonic Technology Open House. Wait till you see the latest technology. And right now, introducing the Panasonic DVD recorder. Hi, this is Tom Campbell. With me is
Sid Pickup, product manager, Panasonic Company.
The most exciting technology in 20 years. No computer needed, just plug it in and use it. This machine does it all. You can put your camcorder into it and record DVDs. It even has a built-in tuner, right, Sid?
It's so easy to use, Tom. Take our direct navigation system. No more fumbling or searching for a program that you want to watch that you've recorded. With a direct navigator, Call it up and go directly to it.
And with the Panasonic DVD recorder, you can go back and watch what was previously recorded while the machine is still recording the show. It's called Time Slip, and it's so easy to use. You can take your camcorder, your videotapes, and move them right over to DVD and erase it and use it over again and again and again. And the price is incredible. Right now, an introductory price at Ken Crane's of $9.98. And there's no computer needed. It's all self-contained.
That's right, Tom.
If you're looking for the finest, look for
Panasonic
at Ken Crane's.
This is KNX 1070.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Stories that matter with the inside knowledge of the correspondents who cover them. Once again, here's CBS News national correspondent Dan Rubin.
Some of the U.S. bombers that have struck Afghanistan fly halfway around the world from America. Others from the Indian Ocean and the Arabian Sea. Reporters had a chance to visit with Navy pilots and support personnel on an aircraft carrier, USS Enterprise, including CBS News reporter Bob Serkin, who got a call through from the ship where the flight operations crew is getting really tired.
The pilots are exhausted. They're flying continuously for 36 hours. The individual sorties are very long. Some of them extend up to 8 hours. The planes have to be refueled several times as they hit their targets over Afghanistan and then linger in the area on patrol for other reasons.
Are you saying that the individual pilots are in the air for 8 hours, come back, and those same men, generally men, those same men then fly out after a short time?
They're getting short rests, and then they're being recycled maybe 10, 11 hours later, and they're up in the air again. The pilots report that they see a lot of anti-aircraft fire coming up, but nothing significant, they say. And to date, the Navy says that no coalition aircraft has been touched by any of this anti-aircraft fire.
Bob, what's the mood like on ship? I know that being on patrol on an aircraft carrier in normal times is frankly boring.
This is what they train for, and you have to keep in mind that just before the September 11th attack took place, this ship was just about on its way home, completing its six-month cruise. They're doing extra duty, but the morale on board ship could not be better, from my opinion.
Turning now to CBS News correspondent Mark Phillips. You spent some time on USS Enterprise. The fact that it has to be done this way from an aircraft carrier, that's in part because of the politics of the region?
They can't run airstrikes out of the military and the Air Force installations and equipment that they have here in the Gulf. I'm speaking now from Bahrain, which, as you know, is right next door to Saudi Arabia, where the U.S. maintains an Air Force presence, and part of the deal was that attack missions on another Muslim country could not be done from here, and that's necessitated bringing the carriers, which right now are the Enterprise and the Carl Vinson, into the Indian Ocean.
Mark, tell me what connection the men and women in uniform feel between what they're doing and the September the 11th attacks on New York and the Pentagon.
They feel very connected, even though they've been away for 6 months and are a distance of several thousand miles. The glamour boys and girls up there fly the planes, but there are more than 5,000 people on that carrier, including the people who prepare the armaments and the munitions.
And in some of your TV reports, Mark, did I see they, in fact, painted messages on the bombs?
There was a lot of that. New York Fire Department, New York Police Department, this from the victims' families. And it was neither discouraged nor encouraged by the officers on board. This was something that the people who prepare the armaments, attach them to the planes, and do the various other work on the carrier felt a need to do, I suppose.
CBS News correspondent Mark Phillips in the Arabian Gulf. It's hard to get accurate information from Afghanistan or into that country. CBS News London correspondent Sam Litzinger tells us how the British do their best.
BBC World Service.
Many Afghans rely on the BBC World Service to get news on what's going on. And British Prime Minister Tony Blair has used it to get a message to them. In a radio interview translated into Pashto, the language of Afghanistan's Pashtun people, he says the West won't abandon them after the air raids are over. It's a kind of winning hearts and minds campaign. But it also suggests how important radio can be in a country where TV sets are banned. Even the Taliban are using radio to get their message across. Peter Friard is with the BBC Monitoring Service, which 24 hours a day listens to broadcasts around the world. He says the Taliban radio operations are telling Afghans to fight. Taliban leaders are using the radio airwaves to try to rally a population that may be ready to desert them.
BBC Monitoring listened to a 15-minute Voice of Sharia bulletin in English, which contained reports that local Taliban commanders had met and were urging local population to resist, and I quote, until the last drop of blood.
The BBC Monitoring Service says the Taliban now seem to be relying on small regional radio operations. The main one in Kabul may well have become a victim of the Allied airstrikes. Peter Friard says he has no doubt many Afghans are huddled somewhere right now, turning a radio dial, trying to tune in the outside world.
There's a long tradition of listening to shortwave radios, although listening to foreign broadcasts is, shall we say, discouraged by the Taliban. The BBC World Service has increased its output in the languages to the region. Voice of America, too, claims a very high audience level.
Broadcasts in Dari and Pashto and Persian, sometimes one of about a dozen other languages, all beamed into Afghanistan. The power of the spoken word in dangerous times.
You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall with a special edition of NewsHour.
For the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Sam Litzinger in London.
Now that it's just over a month since our world changed on September 11th, we at CBS News did a series of reports on the change in us. Here's part of the series.
People have opened up their pocketbooks like never before.
You know, I think this is an unprecedented time.
Former White House spokesman Joe Lockhart says Bill Clinton and his former rival Bob Dole are raising money for college scholarships for children of the victims.
The Clinton-Dole effort is just a reflection of the fact that people have put their differences aside and are working together for a common good.
Thank you for calling about the September 11th Fund.
Thank you for calling the American Red Cross Donor Assistance Line.
If you wish to make a donation to the New York Fire.
Hundreds of millions of dollars have been pledged, but
the proof of the pudding is going to come after this.
Annie Hurwitz of the New York Community Trust says she's not sure if people have changed permanently.
There are still homeless people to be housed and hungry people to be fed.
We still need your help.
Howard Arenstein, CBS News, Washington.
Guess we're aware of the explosion. We heard that it was a plane down. Can you confirm?
For many Americans, the images of that awful day 1 month ago simply won't fade. Many are on anxiety overload. The National Mental Health Association's Dr. Laura Young sees an ongoing fear factor.
There is a loss of innocence. There is this realization that we are vulnerable.
But vulnerability is not necessarily a sign of weakness.
It is a flag. It is a kind of warning to say, pay attention.
Peter Mayer, CBS News, Washington.
Have American appetites for entertainment changed? You might think moviegoers would have lost their taste for violence, but the last 2 weeks saw films from Michael Douglas and Denzel Washington open at the top of the charts. Both pictures contain extremely violent imagery. Some in the industry believe there will be soul searching. Oscar-winning actor Anthony Hopkins says he thinks there'll be discussion about making less violent films.
There will be a movement. There's a movement already underfoot.
While we may not see imploding buildings for a while, it's unlikely much will really change in Hollywood. This New Yorker says he's lost interest, for now, in current movies.
I'd rather spend time doing something creative or helpful.
But he is in a minority. Movie going is up over the same month-long period a year ago. Lisa Carlin, Time Magazine for CBS News, New York.
Listening to the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
It's just over 1 month since everything changed. CBS News correspondent Dan Rather has a lot to say about that. He spoke with the executive producer of the Weekend Roundup, Howard Arenstein.
Dan, it's been a very tough month for America, hasn't it?
It's been a tough month, but a toughening month as well. And if I'm going to judge, I think once the initial shock simmered a little bit, we toughened up. So it's been a tough month, but I think one of the changes in the country is a realization that we are in a new world war, that it will be long-lasting, that there'll be more casualties among Americans, overseas fighting, and very possibly within our own country ourselves. One of the things changed is that we no longer make the assumption that we won't be attacked in our homeland. Because now we have been, we've seen the brutal reality of it. I think the feeling of closeness together is a way we have changed. I'll go ahead and say it. In a city as large as New York, where people sort of prided themselves in anonymity if you wanted it from your neighbors, there has been an unprecedented sense of neighborliness. I think another change has been the heightened sense of vulnerability and the fragility of life. Yes, we know that life can end at any time. But sometimes it takes a cataclysmic event such as this to drive that home. I'm less certain about the next thing I'm going to mention, but I think there has been a turning to a deeper spirituality in the country. Not everybody is religious, but even people who don't consider themselves religious, talking in spiritual terms about being in touch with their inner selves, about the need for spirituality in the country. I think one of the ways we've changed is a realization that while we almost desperately do not want this new world war to be a war between civilizations, and we don't want a new religious war, that having said that, there is deep within us a sense that as much as anything else, our deep spirit and our values are what's at stake. We now know, as we have never known before, certainly not since World War II, that everything's on the table. Everything. That the very values that we treasure the most, our own definition of spirit, everything from national spirit to religious spirit, is at stake. And that hasn't happened in this country in more than half a century, and for at least two generations, we haven't been tested in that way, and that's a fundamental change.
You mentioned fear. There seems to be almost a panic spreading across the country of biological and chemical terrorism. Here in Washington, somebody spraying cleaning fluid in the metro set off hazmat alerts all around the city. That's a major change in how people are thinking about their everyday lives.
Well, certainly people have changed their thinking about everyday life and realizing their vulnerability. And certainly there's fear. You know, one definition of bravery or courage is not that you don't have fear. It's that you recognize fear, you acknowledge your fear, and you go on, drive past it, and do what you have to do. I would gently argue with anyone who describes it as panic. I don't think the country has panicked. I don't think there's panic in the country. I think there is a heightened realization that we're vulnerable, a heightened realization that there's a Trojan horse within our gates, that there are evil enemy people who live among us, and that naturally we're afraid of that. But we don't fear saying we're afraid of it. But I do think there's a national determination to deal with it. On some individual cases, maybe there's been some panic, but I think we're a long way from national panic. I think quite the contrary. I think we're now evolving into a national attitude of we know what we have to do, and among the things we have to do is deal with our fears and then go on and prove that we are indeed the home of the brave.
What about the fear of flying? People seem very hesitant to get on airplanes.
Well, they are hesitant, and with good reason. Why wouldn't they be? That a month after the Trade Center bombings, the mass murder by airliners, we still had some of our airports, the same people, ill-trained, low-paid, all of them good people, decent people, but not nearly the security level that we need at airports. And a month later, we still don't have that. If someone wants to read that as criticism, I don't intend it that way, but I think by any objective analysis, that we're not there yet in instituting the new security measures we need to at airports and on airplanes. So it's all well and good for the president and others to say, listen, get out there, fly, go fly. But each individual person is making his or her decisions about whether it's prudent to fly yet. And an awful lot of people have made the decision, I just don't think it's a good idea just yet.
You mentioned an appreciation of life. A lot of people, especially baby boomers, have been spending a lot of their time working, commuting, working overtime. They seem to want to spend more time with their families.
I think that's true. I think there's been a looking inward to our spirituality of saying, what am I about? How do I want to spend my time? And for so many of us, particularly in America, where the acceleration of the pace of change has been so dramatic just in the last 10 or 15 years, to say nothing of the last 25 or 30 years, that people found themselves before September 11th spending a lot of time on things that really didn't matter. And I do think people are reassessing now and saying, what matters to me? And what matters are, you know, family, spirituality, if not religion, country. These are the things that matter. A lot of the things that we thought before September 11th were important turn out to be trivial, almost to the point of being the toy department.
If you don't want to answer this question, just say so, but I've noticed a change in you. you on the set have been working long hours, working hard days, yet you go on a show like David Letterman and suddenly you're letting your emotions show. You said on the show, I'm a professional, I shouldn't do things like this. But here's a change in Dan Rather.
Dan Rather wouldn't be much of a human being if he didn't change after September 11th. What this is about, it's not about me. It's about those people who died at the Pentagon and in Lower Manhattan and their families. And it's what our country's going to do to survive. That, you know, I don't mind talking about myself, but it's very important to me that people understand that I know it's not about me. I work in an egocentric business. And all of us who are on television are constantly breathing kind of NASA-grade rocket fuel for the ego. But that's not the case with this. It was my job. What I thought I could contribute was to come to work and do my job as best I could, being an honest broker of information. You know what you're feeling inside, but you try not to let it show. And I tried very hard not to let it show, but I don't have any regrets. I have no apology about what happened on the Letterman program. I did feel a very strong sense of grief about what had happened. And I do love my country. I would just as soon it not have shown in that way at that time. But you know, it happens. And it happened.
CBS News anchor Dan Rather chatting there with correspondent Howard Arenstein. If you've got comments, please email us to roundup@cbsnews.com. I'm Dan Ravine.
You're listening to the CBS News Weekend Roundup, the news of the week and the correspondents who covered it on the CBS Radio Network.
President Bush has said again and again that this nation is at war. He calls it a war on terrorism. And he says the United States is sure to win. We're joined in the studio here at CBS News Washington by David Halberstam, author of War in a Time of Peace. Of course, author of, well, some 16 other books, including The Best and the Brightest. This book, a lot of people are calling it a sequel to The Best and the Brightest, which was about the Vietnam War. But when you write about the last President Bush and about former President Clinton, did you have sequel in mind?
It brought me back to the ghosts of Vietnam. I didn't go looking for them. They found me.
And often America's leaders were mentioning that. We're not going to do it like in Vietnam. We're going to have a defined mission. We'll know when to get in and out.
Well, I think two institutions that were so really severely damaged by Vietnam in different ways and institutions that are really vital to a democracy working well. One was the Democratic Party, the other was the United States Army. We sent a good army to fight, in effect, a bad war, and that is a very destructive thing, and it picked up all kinds of viruses, inflated promotions, inflated medals, and in fact, Colin Powell is very, very eloquent on that, and he regards, I think, the thing that he did best in his career as cleansing the army.
Then Bill Clinton takes over as president, probably doesn't even imagine that he'll use the military. He's famous for that phrase. It's the economy, stupid domestic
stuff.
But
then, of course, and he does. There's a moment right before he's inaugurated. He comes to Washington. He meets with the House Democratic Committee chairman, and he's very casually comes around. It's Lee Hamilton's turn. He's the Democratic House Affairs Committee, and Clinton says something, you know, what are your problems? And Lee says, well, I got China, half the people will like what you do and half won't, and I've got Iraq, you got Saddam Hussein. Clinton interrupts him, said, you know, Lee, I've been out campaigning for a year. You know, nobody cares about foreign policy, maybe a handful of journalists. And it meant to him there were no votes in it.
And then when a Republican is elected, Al Gore loses, George Bush's son, George W., wins the presidency. Colin Powell does join the government, but the current president also has a defense secretary, Rumsfeld, with great experience. A vice president, of course, Cheney,
with very considerable experience. But I think it's, you know, likely to be a strong team. They've had a lot of time in grade. They've been through comparable experiences before. There's a respect for each other. I think Rumsfeld is, on occasion, quite territorial, and I think when he first got in, he was a bit territorial, and there was some sense that perhaps he was trying to squeeze a Secretary Powell out. And then, of course, September 11th changes everything. You don't need to be territorial. There's enough on everybody's plate. No one is going to be short of work, let me tell you.
When you write about how military power was used during the Clinton administration, where there wasn't a clear event like September 11th.
There hasn't been a clear event like this since, really, Pearl Harbor. You could say that the Cold War, the challenge from the Soviets, is this, but not as crystal clear. I think in terms of a demarcation from, in effect, yesterday and today, then and now, you go back to Pearl Harbor. In terms of what it represents as a threat, it's much more like the Cold War, a long twilight struggle with no one single victory, but a, you know, where you have to use complex resources of the society, and in this case, against a very difficult enemy.
And that enemy will never come onto the battleship Missouri and sign a surrender.
No, if you are successful, as in a kind of guerrilla war, if you're successful, the war will go away. This is going to be very difficult, hard struggle. It's difficult to apply our power, our military power, our high technology power. If we use too much military power, we may do his recruiting for him. It's much more about security, about intelligence, about tightening up the places where the enemy operates, whether in Europe or in the Middle East. It's very hard, and he's strongest where we are traditionally weakest.
That terrorist leader, whoever, yes, yeah, whether it's the Osama or
the variety of top terrorist leaders, and they're going to be a very considerable foe.
But
and they challenge the very openness of the society.
Based on what you learned, can we respond? Did the U.S. lose so much fighting capability that maybe we can't?
Oh, no, we haven't lost fighting capability. We've got terrific fighting capability. This is an extraordinary military. You don't get ahead in the United States military in this smaller elite army and military force that we have today, unless you are very good. If you have the Vietnam generation beginning to pass, and I think you do, you lose something because you lose some of the people who are tempered by it. I mean, I think one of the things, very important things in Colin Powell's experience, the two tours in Vietnam.
And he's now Secretary of State, so he's in there.
I think if you look back at Colin Powell's breadth of career and the positions he's held, you might have to go back to George Catlett Marshall to find an American of comparable experience at those levels under terrible pressures. I mean, I think you could make a case that the era in which Marshall served was an easier one, given the different pressures on a high-level public official.
As you say, you're a fan of Powell.
Well, but I think not just Powell. I mean, I think we may be underestimating how good the general's top team of people we are. I think Powell is he's the most public of him for a variety of reasons. He's become the poster boy of the military because his own story is so dramatic one. But I think there are a lot of other people there that are also quite superior. I don't think we should underestimate the quality of people we have at the top. What is important is our resolve, our agenda, our leadership in not so much in the public leadership, but the private sector. Will they make sacrifices? Will people who own large communications companies always want to drive the stock up relentlessly each year, which I think has given us a narrower focus on the world than we should have.
So far, the signs are good. The first days of our crisis, no commercials on
network TV. Well, that's easy. That's easy. That's an automatic. That's the Pavlovian response. I think the real test will come in 6 or 7 weeks, particularly after they get the bottom line of not having had commercials, of how much money it cost them, and are they going to try and, you know, drive blood out of the stone in the next year to make up for it and cut back on are they going to keep foreign reporting there? And they have not. They have, in fact, binged in the last 10 years. I mean, you know, that absorption with Congressman Gary Condon, I mean, around-the-clock surveillance watch of media teams on his house and the Levy family's house, I mean, that's a symbol of the madness of the last era.
Thinking the public would watch it, and
we had a very trivial agenda, and we began to think we were immune to the rest of the world, that reporting on foreign policy brought lower ratings, people didn't care, the pollsters seemed to show that. So we trivialized the agenda, and we made ourselves ill-prepared for the new era that has just started.
Something we face even here at CBS News, and we'll continue to do so.
I'm sure.
David Halberstam, author of War in a Time of Peace, Bush, Clinton, and the Generals, published by Scribner's. Yeah. Best of luck with the book. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
More now in our series of reports on how we've changed since September the 11th.
At first, we tuned out and stayed away, but now we're returning to our familiar pop culture in droves.
Do you see that with the inappropriate and the pinching?
Actually, I did.
Television's Friends recently enjoyed its best rating in 5 years.
I need you to help me.
You want what they want.
Helped by thrillers like Don't Say a Word, Hollywood has reaped two strong weekends at the box office. Americans are escaping, or as USC historian Stephen Ross puts it, seeking entertainment comfort food.
People are going back to familiar forms of entertainment, their comedies, their films. This brings them a level of comfort.
David Dow, CBS News, Hollywood.
It's tough to find a seat these days in the Unity Church in Overland Park, Kansas.
I would say the first Sunday afterwards, we had more people than we have on our biggest day.
Minister Greg Barrett says many people are struggling for answers since the September 11th attacks.
They're trying to reconcile the teachings of certainly nonviolence and peacefulness with the possible need to take military action.
And kids ask perhaps the hardest question of all. Why did it happen?
I just had to start off with, they made a mistake.
Barrett says Americans are known for their resilience, but what happened 1 month ago left an indelible mark on the nation.
It may wake us up to a little more compassion and a little more responsible look at how we live in a world rather than just an isolated corner of the globe.
Charlotte Berg, CBS News.
New York City mom Dot Lauterstein changed after the attacks, told her 10-year-old son he could choose his after-school music.
You know, Dan, I want to buy an electric guitar and an amp and plug it in and wang away. That's just fine with me. Because what does that really matter in the long run?
A University of Washington sociologist says after tragedy,
we see towards life, not towards death.
So Pepper Schwartz says,
you're going to see more eroticism, more intimacy seeking, and more sex.
It's been a difficult time for Nick Webb.
Nobody's sleeping very well, and I know I'm just incredibly scatterbrained right now.
He escaped from the World Trade Center and is running his financial information company from home in Connecticut. His wife, kids, and dog are close by.
Things that count the most are, you know, spending time with your family, spending time of the kids, not letting things get to you, you know, enjoying life.
Dave Barrett, CBS News.
Since September 11th, the nation's police officers, firemen, and EMS workers have become new heroes, especially to children.
I think firemen and police are heroes because they save other people that are in danger.
And firemen risk their lives every time they go into a burning building.
A lot of firemen had to risk their lives to help other people in those twin towers.
Firemen like Sam Church have noticed a new appreciation for what they do.
People just salute, throw thumbs up, and it's a good feeling.
Sales of firemen and police Halloween costumes are up more than 100% this year. Jim Crisula, CBS News, Greensboro, North Carolina.
In every war and crisis, civil liberties have been compromised. Georgetown University professor David Cole says it's happening again.
The government's attitude is, look, give us incredibly broad powers and trust us.
He says the history of past abuse shows Americans need to be wary. The British government has a longer history with terrorism and uses surveillance cameras on the street and can hold suspects without trial. Nadine Strossen, president of the ACLU, says that won't fly here.
We in America do put, and always have put, greater priority on individual freedom.
But Attorney General John Ashcroft says the FBI does need more power.
We need to be able to put tools in place that would help us disrupt or prevent any additional terrorist acts.
Bob Fuss, CBS News, Washington.
The first time Robert Franklin took a flight after the September 11th attacks, he sat behind a Middle Eastern-looking man. A flight attendant, African-American as Franklin is, approached, chatting with each passenger, until she saw that man.
Meanwhile, I'm calculating how I might disarm him, his strength relative to mine.
Franklin, president of Atlanta's Interdenominational Theological Center, then saw the man was reading Islam's holy book, the Quran.
Frankly, I felt embarrassed and annoyed with both myself and this flight attendant for reaching such alarmist conclusions.
He and she were guilty of the same racial profiling blacks often experience from police, Franklin acknowledges. In the climate now,
it's a tough call for most law enforcement.
National polls show most Americans now believe it's sometimes necessary for police to target specific groups, even though liberties are lost in the process. Barry Bagnato, CBS News, Washington.
We hear the reports on the radio.
770 people have been screened for anthrax.
Fears in the air of a new kind of terrorist attack.
Threats from biological and chemical agents are real.
Some, like Tennessee Republican Senator Bill Frist, think a biological or chemical assault could be more deadly and destructive than the attacks on the Pentagon and the World Trade Center. Those fears are backed up by the American Public Health Association. Dr. Muhammad Akhtar says emergency services personnel should be vaccinated.
We should seriously consider providing our firefighters
making available these vaccines.
John Schwartz co-authored a book on bioterrorism and has this warning.
It's not a question of if, it's a question of when.
Pamela McCall, CBS News, New York.
It's spread out here from Ground Zero, a huge American flag hanging atop the rubble, giving birth to shoulder patches and stickers on hard hats, in truck and car windows. American flags, more than a symbol of patriotism, but of unity and resilience. Not as prevalent in this Walmart parking lot in southern Illinois.
In all honesty, it's because we're so far away from the big cities and places that I think would be targets.
But no less patriotic.
I always love my country. My wife and I both do.
Initially, manufacturers couldn't meet the demand, but by the time this Columbus Day parade stepped off here in New York, it was a virtual sea of red, white, and blue.
The patriotism of the American.
Lou Milliano, CBS News.
You may well sympathize with the commentary for this weekend roundup by Charles Grodin.
Even though it wasn't that long ago, I'm starting to think about events prior to September 11th as the good old days of the news. Oh, I wish we were still talking about President Clinton and Monica Lewinsky. I never dreamt I'd feel nostalgic about Monica Lewinsky. Oh, for the good old days when we speculated about who touched whom where. What's the meaning of alone and is? I've even developed a strange fondness for the whole impeachment proceeding and all those colorful House managers. I miss hearing Henry Hyde talking about his youthful indiscretions when he was in his 40s. It seems just like yesterday that we were fascinated by the color of Al Gore's clothes and George Bush's unique use of words. The Chads. I miss hearing about the Chads. My favorite was the hanging Chad. I never got that excited about the indented Chads. I long to again hear about Gary Condit, who ran with the slogan, "A good example," and seemed every day to come up with new ways to show he wasn't. I really miss the good old days of the news.
Charles Grodin, who also has commentaries every week on the CBS News TV broadcast, 60 Minutes 2. Please join us next week right here on the radio. I'm Dan Revive.
You've been listening to the CBS News Weekend Roundup. This broadcast is produced in the Washington Bureau of CBS News. The program is produced by Howard Arenstein, Craig Warner, and John Harchin. This is the CBS Radio Network.
CBS News, I'm Cammie McCormick.
It turns out that there's another letter.
New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani this afternoon clearing up some questions over an anthrax case involving a female NBC News employee. Originally, a letter postmarked September 20th was suspected. Now it turns out an earlier letter is tested positive. This one postmarked September 18th in Trenton, New Jersey. It was addressed to Tom Brokaw. Barry Mon is the head of the FBI in New York.
There was no return address. It was an anonymous letter. White envelope.
The woman and assistant to Brokaw is expected to make a complete recovery, but Giuliani says more NBC News employees may have to be screened.
358 people so far have been tested at NBC. We will have to go back somewhat and see if there are more people that need to be tested.
We're still waiting for word from Reno, Nevada authorities on a letter there that was being tested for anthrax. A first test was positive, a second one negative. The Defense Department today confirmed that a Navy jet missed its intended target in Afghanistan. It was aiming for a helicopter at Kabul Airport. Instead, a 2,000-pound bomb was dropped on a civilian area. CBS News military consultant, former Naval officer Stan Weeks.
Could be something with a bomb. The guidance and the fins didn't function like it was supposed to. It could be in the laser device.
The Pentagon says it regrets the loss of any civilian life. Reports on the ground indicate there were anywhere between one and four deaths. The USS Kitty Hawk is in position, its decks cleared of planes. It may be used for ground forces if they're needed. CBS News correspondent Bob Serkin is aboard the USS Enterprise in the Arabian Sea.
Following a day of being replenished with jet fuel, food, and other supplies, the crew of the Enterprise is resuming nighttime airstrikes against Taliban targets. There's still a lot left to do, says the ship's commanding officer, whose name can't be used. Flying through skies more clear of dust and fog, pilots will have an easier time finding their targets, but the commander says flight crews will continue making last-minute decisions not to drop their weapons to avoid collateral damage. Bob Serkin, CBS News, aboard the USS Enterprise in the North Arabian Sea.
The U.S. humanitarian aid drops are continuing. Reporter Phil Itner in northern Afghanistan tells us those supplies are not getting to everyone who needs them.
Early in the morning, we had some American planes that dropped food packets onto the open plain outside of this small village. The problem with that was that the only way many of the people could get to these drop zones was actually by car or donkey. By the time the refugees got there on foot, much of the food had already been taken.
Those food drops have included peanut butter, jam, and Pop-Tarts, but the instructions on the packets have been in English and Spanish. This is CBS News.
Buying a home? Grab a pencil and get ready to jot down a number that'll get you a complimentary home buyer's kit prepared by the Real Estate Buyer's Agent Council, a division of the National Association of Realtors. Learn about prices, locations, financing, taxes, inspections, title searches, escrows, closing costs, in short, everything you need to know about home buying. Learn how to contact an accredited buyer representative, a real estate pro trained to assist home buyers. For your home buyer's kit, call 1-800-648-6224. 1-800-648-6224.
This is Joe Montana. I love playing football. The pain got tough sometimes, but we played on. I was sure happy the trainers used the pain-relieving gel as quick and long-lasting as Maximum Strength Flexol. Flexol's power and speed helps keep pro athletes in the game, and I still rely on Flexol. On the golf course, on my horse ranch, or just horsing around with my kids. When arthritis and other tough pain flares up, Flexol still keeps me going strong.
Maximum Strength Flexol. Powerful, full-speed relief for tough pain. Use as directed.
20,000 people took part in a peace protest today in central London. It was one of the largest of several protests throughout Europe. More than 20,000 people also turned out in Berlin. A Newsweek poll out today finds 89% of Americans support the military action in Afghanistan, but many also worry it will lead to more terrorist attacks in the United States. 88% of those surveyed approve of the way President Bush is handling his job as president. CBS News correspondent Mark Noller reports the president so far isn't changing his future travel plans.
If the president follows his own advice of going about his normal business, then he'll be leaving the country next week for the first time since the attack on America. He is scheduled to embark Wednesday on a trip to the Asia-Pacific Economic Conference in Shanghai, China, next weekend.
Allied warplanes attacked military installations in southern Iraq today. The U.S. Central Command saying the planes hit a command and control target in response to continued threats to Allied planes. I'm Cammie McCormick, CBS News.